Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to Money Talk on Friday, the 12th of September. We're broadcasting from Haglands in Dymchurch, and as Paul Andrews and I often used to joke, it is another sunny day. We looked like we were going to have the autumn, but summer is back again, probably very briefly. My name is Simon Webster. I rejoice in the Twitter handle MoneyTalk_Guru. And for my day job, I am Managing Director of Facts and Figures, Chartered Financial Planners based in Ashford. The last 3 months or so have seen us put together a series of shows on matters financial to try and give listeners some idea of what financial advisors do, how financial markets work, the sort of things to look out for, and the sort of things to avoid. Today's show, we're going to focus on funds and investments, what they are, how they work, how to get the best out of them, and what to avoid. But as we are just a week away from the Scottish independence vote on the 18th, I thought it would probably be sensible to say a few words on that. It's all over the news at the moment. What would be the consequences in financial markets of Scotland becoming independent? Well, it's very hard to call, but it would certainly introduce a period of uncertainty, because it's not like the Scottish people will vote to be independent and then the next day they'll be an independent country and a whole new set of rules and regulations and government will be in place, because it doesn't happen like that. There will be a protracted period of negotiation between the Scottish government and the English government, or the remainder of the UK government, depending on how you want to look at it, and that negotiation could take several months or indeed several years. There are still a lot of unanswered questions about what's going to happen to the currency. The Yes campaign are very much in favour of continuing to use sterling. The Governor of the Bank of England have said Scotland would have to cede a fairly large element of sovereignty in order to so do. Then there is the question of EU membership. The Scots seem to think that it would be possible to get straight into the European Union. They don't listen to the argument that countries such as Spain have got their own factions vying for independence, and if the Spanish have to agree to Scotland as an independent country becoming an EU member, it won't happen, because as soon as Spain votes yes for that to happen, the Basque will say us too, and Spain cannot allow that to happen. And Spain is not the only country. We've already heard during the week that many of the financial institutions which base themselves in Scotland at the moment may well relocate south of the border. And there is a very strong regulatory and financial reason for doing that. It's got nothing to do with politics and nothing particularly much to do with tax. It has got everything to do with the fact that the capitalisation of these large financial institutions is such that they need to be backed by the Bank of England. There is no way that being backed by an independent Bank of Scotland is going to make their position sustainable going forward. Of course, that will result in jobs moving south as well. So there's a whole pile of reasons why moving for independence for Scotland is possibly not the most logical thing that they could do. Having said that, this is an argument about heart as much as head, so there's a very serious possibility that the Scottish people may decide we're not really worried about the financial consequences, we just will feel better about ourselves and our country if we are truly independent. To me, as a Brit with no real axe to grind either way, it just strikes me as counterintuitive that at a time when much of the world is seeking to work together, and the EU is a prime example, a small country like Scotland would seek to go it alone and imagine that they would somehow be better off in that way. I don't see it myself, but it's a balanced argument and it'll go to the wire and the Scottish people will decide next week. It will be interesting to see what happens. Let's turn now to funds and investments. Really, there are broadly two things that you can do with your money. You can deposit it or you can invest it. Now, deposits we all usually understand. You give banks your money, or building societies your money, in exchange for interest. Your capital is secure in monetary terms. You get this rate of interest, which at the moment is low and can be varied by the deposit-taking institution at whim. And of course, sadly, the value of your capital is eroded by inflation. So if you put £10,000 in a building society on the 1st of January, by the 31st of December, it will buy less stuff than it could have done at the beginning of the year. And when interest rates and inflation rates are almost the same, you can effectively see that all your money will do while it's on deposit is mark time. Now, there's been much speculation about what's going to happen to interest rates in the longer term. We've had a situation for nearly 5 years where we've had this almost ridiculously low bank base rate, which has depressed interest rates and made borrowing cheaper for everybody. But it's also meant that those with money on deposit who live off their income have found their income squeezed terribly. And this is very regrettable. Longer term, I think most people agree, and I certainly feel, that interest rates will start to creep up again towards the end of this year, beginning of next. But the next bank base rate rise will in fact only be 0.25%, which will make next to no difference to anybody other than sending a signal to the market that the holiday of super cheap interest rates is now over. But the truth is, it'll probably be another 6 months after that before they go up another 0.25%. So there is not going to be a sudden recovery in interest rates in the near future. And I think we're probably looking at a longer term base rate of nearer 3% than the 5% that we enjoyed for the several years in the run up to the current lows. We talked about capital being eroded by inflation. The other reason people like deposit is access. You can get hold of your money when it's on deposit relatively quickly and easily. However, in order to get halfway decent interest rates, you often have to put your money away, giving 30, 60, 90 days notice, or even 6 months, 1 year, or 2 years. And some of these products are structured so that you get an interest bonus on the 12-month or 24-month anniversary. And if you pull your money out early, the actual interest rate you earn is far lower. A little by the by, deposit-taking institutions are covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, but only up to £85,000. So if you put £100,000 in and your lender, sorry, your deposit taker collapses, then £15,000 will not come back to you. So it's worth spreading your deposits around. But here's another question for you to consider. What does the deposit taker do with the money that you lend it? Effectively, you're lending the deposit taker your money. Well, in the main, the deposit taker invests it. The most obvious example being, you give money to a building society in exchange for one rate of interest, and the building society lends that interest out at a higher rate to people who want to buy houses. Now, the interesting thing is, a lot of people say to me, well, the nice thing about cash is nobody's charging me any money. The interest I get is charge-free. Well, of course, that rather depends on how you look at it. You get what it says on the side of the tin. That is most certainly true. So if they say they're going to give you 2%, that's what you get, at least until they change it. But if they're lending that money to people buying houses at 4% and they're paying you 2%, then the cost of your deposit is effectively the 2% spread between what they're lending it out at and what they're paying you. And in truth, that's the sort of cost of running most investments one way or the other. There are cheaper investments out there, but it's an interesting benchmark that the cost of deposits is something between 1.5% to 2%, depending on the spread between deposit rates and lending rates. Clearly, the building societies and the banks make money out of taking deposits in. Otherwise, they would not be able to support their business models. So this is one of the main reasons I tend to the opinion that cash deposits is the place for short-term money, which you might need access for. But I tend myself to think that for longer-term returns, one is better off cutting out the middleman and investing oneself. The big problem with investments is that you may get back less than you put in, and they're complicated. We've got over 40,000 different funds and investment vehicles on our database, and in fact, if you start adding in some other categories, the number goes up even higher than that. But the whole point of getting out less than you put in introduces the concept of risk, and why some people refer to investing as effectively going to the casino. Now, I think that's a gross exaggeration of the position, and that's why it pays to try and stack the odds in your favour, and that is what much of this edition will be about. But the reality of the situation is many investments are just putting your money into things that people buy and use every day. And if you're sensible about it, somebody would have had to push a button on a nuclear missile for investments to be a complete disaster. But that does not mean that investments are immune from short-term fluctuation. Far from it. More of that later. Now, the real debate is about people's appetite or comprehension of risk and what risk actually means, and as the regulator would have us put it, their capacity for loss. So I'm going to spend a minute just unpicking that a little bit. There are some people, a lot of them are business people, who are used to the concept of taking risks. You need to speculate to accumulate. So people who have their own businesses, and I'm one of them as it happens, are used to the idea that you've got to put your house up if you want to borrow money to build your business, and if your business goes wrong, you could lose your house. They're used to the idea that if you want to actually make more profit in your firm, you might have to buy a £100,000 piece of machinery with money you have to borrow from the bank, and if it doesn't work, the bank could take your business. They're used to that idea, but they're also used to the idea that when it goes right, they get what's sometimes referred to as a risk premium, a decent return over and above the rate of interest they would have got for deposit investments. Those that do not work on a self-employed basis and have not played in the investment markets before might be very nervous about buying an asset whose value could go down as well as up. And those sort of people are generally referred to in the trade as risk averse. But it's a real trade-off for members of the public, because if you are risk averse, but you still want a halfway decent return or even need a halfway decent return, you have to take some risk. There is no decent return that comes totally risk-free. And anybody who tells you different is probably lying. So bear that one in mind. The truth of the matter is that to get a decent return, you have to take an element of risk. So the question you have to ask yourself is, how much risk are you prepared to take? Now, risk is usually measured in the trade as in terms of volatility. Now, volatility is how much the value of assets goes down and go up. In statistical terms, it's sometimes referred to as standard deviation. If you can imagine a graph line rising slowly upwards from left to right, that would be a nice predictable growth curve. Effectively, it would be a growth straight line, which would be very nice. The reality, however, is investments do not perform like that. They have good periods and bad periods. They have periods where they go up fairly fast and periods when they can go down fairly fast as well. So you end up with a series of peaks and troughs, hopefully charting a generally upward trend, but by no means that's guaranteed. But if you take your investment return from the lowest trough on the graph and then look to the next biggest peak on the graph, you could actually make a very significant return in that short period based on the movement between trough and peak. But over a much longer term, what you tend to find happens is that the volatility, the movements between peaks and troughs, even out. They come out in the wash, and you just get a general halfway decent trend. So longer-term investing is probably the best bet. The longer you have to put your money away, the longer before you actually need it for something, the more inclined one might be to take an element of risk, because the peaks and arrows or peaks and troughs of outrageous investment performance tend to even out in the long term. If you're short term, then the chances are you're probably going to be better off in cash. Putting your money into cash deposits would almost certainly be your best bet if you were going to be investing for 3 years or less. And you just have to swallow the fact that you're going to get a pretty poor return. But at least you know that if you need your money in 3 years' time, and there's been an investment market adjustment of some sort, then you're not going to suddenly find that you've got a lot less money than you were budgeting for. Now, the other important aspect of looking at clients' attitude to risk is their capacity for loss. If you were lucky enough to have, let's say, £1 million, and you were talking about a £100,000 investment, you could probably afford to be very speculative with that money, because if you lost 100 grand, you'd still have £900,000 left. If, on the other hand, you were talking about a £100,000 investment and that was all the money you had in the world to provide you with an income in your retirement, you could not afford to be quite so risky, because your capacity to deal with the loss of that money, or a significant loss to a section of that money, would not be as great. And so when you're considering how you're going to invest or deposit your money, you need to balance what your gut tells you about your attitude to risk and what your head tells you about your capacity for loss, to make sure you don't put yourself in a situation where you've overstretch yourself and a downturn in investment markets will leave you in a very uncomfortable position. However, there is a very important point here, and I make this with every single investment client that ever sits in my office. And that is this. You could invest your £100,000 today, and in 6 months' time, your investment statement might say £80,000. The uninitiated would then say, I've lost 20 grand. My response is, no, you haven't. You've just had a £20,000 negative fluctuation. Now, that's not an attempt to dress up what is obviously an unfortunate situation with comprehensive or complicated lingo. It's just a statement of fact, because you've only lost the money if you actually encash your investment at the £80,000 value. 6 months again further on, those same investments might be worth £110,000. And you haven't made a £10,000 profit, you've just seen a £10,000 upward fluctuation. But if you encashed at that point, over your 12-month period, first six down 20, second six up 30, quite nice, you've just seen 10% gain, which would be pretty darn reasonable. But it would be, or would have been, a very bumpy and uncomfortable ride to have endured. So it's really very important to understand the difference between fluctuation, which are just things that happen to markets in the ordinary course of events. The market goes up, the market goes down every single day. And that's true for every single stock market, bond market, money market. They all go up a bit or down a bit every single day. And it's just fluctuation. Nobody's made or lost any money unless they sell assets for, in the case of loss, for less than they paid for those assets. Now, the next stage of the conversation is to talk a little bit about investments, but I need to wet my whistle and you need a break. So let's have some Julie London. Hello?
No.
I'm sorry, Jules isn't here at the moment.
You cry the long night through.
No, well, I'm afraid not. This is a remote station. There's no, there's not a conversation you can have here on that. I'm actually live on air, so I've got to go. Sorry.
I cried a river over you. No. Being so untrue, well, you can cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. You drove me, nearly drove me out of my head, while you never shed a tear. Remember, I remember all that you said. Told me love was too plebeian. Told me you were through with me. And now you say you love me. Just to prove you do. Come on and cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you.
That's not something that anybody's probably heard for a good long while. But I first heard that about 25 years ago. And Julie London, who I don't think is any longer with us, just has a wonderful voice. And that's just truly beautiful. So let's talk about investments specifically. There are five main asset classes. Now, if I tell you what the five main asset classes are, that will probably explain to you what asset classes, or the term asset classes, actually mean. But the main asset classes are equities, stocks and shares, fixed income, which in this context is sometimes referred to as bonds, cash equivalents, generally speaking money market type investments, property, and lastly commodities, which range from anything from fresh orange juice, made famous in Trading Places, that well-known film, through precious and not so precious metals, to oil. So asset classes are different stuff that you can buy with your money in the hope of getting a return. And the purpose of breaking down the asset classes is that they behave differently in any given set of economic circumstances. So you can break the five main asset classes down in a number of ways through geographical. So you can have UK equities and US equities, European or Far Eastern. And you can do the same thing with government bonds, sovereign debt. And you can also break them down into subcategories. So, for example, UK equities, you might look at industrials and retail. In fact, we'll do that in a little bit more detail in a second. But one of the things to bear in mind is your selection of individual investments is probably secondary to the way you allocate your investments between equities, bonds, cash, property, and alternatives, which will be the principal determinant of your investment results. For instance, in an environment where inflation and interest rates are high, cash will generally perform well. Bonds perform poorly when expectations are that future inflation will be high, and equities perform well when the outlook for growth in corporate profits is good. And this is often when interest rates are low. Similarly, property performs well in low interest rates environments. And in fact, the idea that spreading investments between different asset classes improves overall performance was scientifically proven by a chap called Harry Markowitz, who in 1990 was awarded the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences for his book Modern Portfolio Theory. Now, I have to tell you, I have been a financial advisor for 30 years. And I once attempted to read Harry Markowitz's book, Modern Portfolio Theory. I got as far as the first half a page, and my brain exploded. The maths that he uses to prove his point is so complicated that it's almost impossible to really understand unless you've got an advanced degree in maths and economics, which I haven't. But the key point is a number of very smart people with slide rules had a look at Harry's work and agreed with him that the way to guarantee the best possible outcome for invested money is to spread your money between different asset classes effectively. It is possible to go to a stockbroker and buy some shares, some bonds, or some money market instruments, but which ones? How do you choose and how do you make money out of your purchase? I will suggest later that for most people, buying a basket of investments, sometimes referred to as collectives, is probably the best bet, but more of that later. Let's just start building this up a bit. Most people are familiar with the concept of buying a house. Let's pretend you find a house that you like for £100,000. If you live in the southeast, that's probably a forlorn hope, but let's pretend. We'll ignore the fact that you might need a loan to buy that house and pretend that you pay cash. And let's assume that this house is an investment. You really have two ways of making money out of it. One, you hope that the price of the house will go up, and when you sell it, you'll get more for it than you paid for it. Of course, it is possible that the price of the house will go down, but that's another conversation. The second way of making money out of your property is from rental income. So you would put tenants in the house, they would pay you rent for the privilege of being in the property, and you would trouser that money, which is great. You'll also have certain costs, the cost of acquisition, legal fees, stamp duty. You'd have stamp duty if the property was more expensive, but you get the idea. Estate agent fees, your time in selecting the right property. You'll also have management and maintenance costs, and ultimately you will also have disposal costs come the time to get rid of the property. When you tally up all the income and gains and take off the expenses, you will know your overall return, and you will then pay capital gains tax on any increase in value and income tax on your rent. In fact, you pay the income tax annually, but you get the idea. For many people, the concept that you could buy a whole house spare for investment is alien, because it's either too much money or takes too much time, or there's too much risk involved in putting all your money into one house. And that's particularly true if you're older and you've got to start dealing with bolshy tenants who decide not to pay the rent. And you buy one house, they could decide to put a motorway extension in front of your property, and that could totally trash its value. So an alternative might be to buy a share in a house with, say, three friends, and you each own a quarter. Or you might buy with 99 friends, and you each own 1% of the house, and you each take a quarter or 1% of the gains and losses, and a quarter or 1% of the income. In our 100 friends together, all 100 of you could decide that you will buy 10 properties in different parts of the country to minimise your risk, and you each put in £10,000, and you each own 1% of each of the 10 houses. And then you could divvy up the gains and losses and income as previously. Of course, you would then probably also then need to deduct a portfolio management fee, as someone would have had to decide which properties to buy, appointed the management company to deal with the actual tenants, and then deal with those and keep the books. And that, of course, is what a fund manager does. Of course, if you need to get your money out, you might need one of the other 99 to buy you out, or you might try and sell your interest to a third party. But even with 100 people involved, it might be a little tricky to get your money out straight away. And this, of course, is the principle of collectivisation, where you can buy a small share in a much larger and typically multi-million pound portfolio of different investments, be that property, stocks and shares, money market, corporate bonds or whatever. And then you can trade those shares because there's a much more flexible and fluid market in buying and selling units in collective investments than there is in buying shares of relatively narrowly invested property. But it's perhaps worth noting that it can sometimes be tricky to get your money out of any commercial property fund, because if there's a run on that asset class, it can sometimes take a while for a big fund to sell a huge office or shopping complex. But to be clear, that will be quite unusual, and most funds keep enough cash handy to allow a fast exit for the average investor or the average number of investors at any given time. We've spent a fair amount of time looking at property, but we've done this because it's an asset class that most people understand. They've often purchased a house to live in. But what about other assets? Let's say shares. A share is a piece of paper conferring ownership of part of a business. It gives its holder entitlement to vote at annual general meetings that theoretically determine how the company is run. We won't do a section on corporate governance now, but that's a little bit of a sore point with a lot of investors. But in theory, share ownership gives you an opportunity to vote at annual general meeting. The paper is asset-backed. So if the company owns buildings, stocks, or intellectual property, a share gives you ownership of a small piece of that. And most importantly, it also gives you entitlement to a share in the company's profits. If the company makes a profit, its directors can decide to reinvest those profits in purchasing more plant, more buildings, more stock, or indeed in research and development. Or the company can decide to pay out some of those profits as a dividend, a thank you to those who hold the company's shares in return for having their money tied up. If you look at the UK stock market, the FTSE index, the average dividend yield, the average income return for stocks and shares on the FTSE is about 3%. And that's 3% a year. And the interesting thing on that is that, of course, when you're only going to get about 2% from a cash investment or a cash deposit, then a 3% yield on stocks and shares suddenly looks very attractive. Of course, your capital does fluctuate if you own stocks and shares, and its cash value is effectively guaranteed when it's on a deposit, but it also guarantees it's going to give you back less in real terms at the end of a period because inflation erodes the value of your capital when you deposit money as a guarantee, whereas, of course, your actual final capital value of your stocks and shares will depend on market forces, which could be in your favour or not. That's the risk. A share is valued in a number of ways, or a share's value is determined based on a number of different criteria. It comes in at several levels. First off, there's the fixed asset value, the actual value of stuff the company owns, its buildings, its machines, that sort of thing. And then it may have a value in its intellectual property. This is particularly true in technology companies where they hold a goodly slug of, I don't know, IT programs are worth money, or they might have some patents. The next element is the goodwill element. It's the extra value the market thinks the company has because it is and hopefully will continue to make profits in the future. There's also then, on top of all of that, market sentiment over a particular market, UK equity, over a particular segment, let's say utilities, and the market may have a view on that. So, for example, if the government or its regulators were starting to make noises about the fact that the utility companies were overcharging, the market might respond by downvaluing utility company shares because there's a concern that their ability to charge what they like and make excess profits will be controlled by regulation. For a UK investor, there are several equity markets to consider. We all hear about the FTSE every day, but in fact, there are a number of FTSE indices, and we'll look at that. The FTSE is an index composed of the FTSE 100 is an index composed of the 100 largest companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. These are often referred to as blue chip companies, and the index is seen traditionally as a good indication of the performance of major companies listed in the UK. The FTSE 100 name originates from when it was owned 50-50 by the Financial Times and the London Stock Exchange. Hence, FTSE, FTSE, being FT from the Financial Times and SE for the Stock Exchange. The FTSE 100 is now maintained by the FTSE Group, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the London Stock Exchange. And although the FTSE 100 is the most famous index the company produces, the FTSE Group also calculates over 100,000 other indices covering markets around the world every day. In the UK market, the other FTSE UK indices include the FTSE 250, the next 250 largest companies after the FTSE 100, and the FTSE Small Cap, the companies smaller than those. The FTSE 100 and the FTSE 250 together make up the FTSE 350, add in the FTSE Small Cap, and you get the FTSE All Share. Confused? Well, I'm sorry, I didn't make it up. That's just the way it works. The FTSE 100 was launched on the 3rd of January 1984 and had a start value of 1,000. Since then, the makeup of the index has changed almost beyond recognition with mergers, takeovers and disappearing companies, underlying the index's purpose of acting as a barometer of market activity. A fair number of constituents have changed their names too. Remember Midland Bank? That's now HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation. Commercial Union is now Aviva, mind you, so is Norwich Union. Reckitt and Coleman are now Reckitt, I can't even say it, Benckiser, and British Gas is now the BG Group and Centrica. The various FTSE companies can be broken down by geographical region, by size or market cap, as it's referred to in the trade, and they can also be broken down by business sector, something I alluded to earlier. So you might have industrials, basic materials, consumer durables or staples, consumer cyclicals, technology, healthcare, financials, energy and utilities. The biggest share market in the world is in the US, which is tracked on the Dow Jones Index. We also think about Europe, Asia and the Far East. Japan used to be regarded as a market in its own right. And we now have the emerging markets with the newer economies, sometimes once referred to as BRIC, which was Brazil, Russia, India and China, and now MINT, Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria and Turkey. So there's a fair number of equity markets to consider and play with. But for now, it's time for a quick break.
Channel Radio, broadcasting from Hagelands Village on Romney Marsh, 24 hours a day. Channel Radio.
Temp Network have hundreds of vacancies across West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531-777. Let's work it to the bone, 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 bone.
This is Simon Webster. You're listening to Money Talk on Channel Radio. It's good to have you with me. We've been looking at investments and investment markets. We've just spent a bit of time talking about how investments can be broken up into collectives. We looked at property as an example, and then we then spent a bit of time talking about stocks and shares. But the interesting thing is, of course, that what then happens is the fund manager person, the guy that was holding your property to investment together, can also hold together, if he's got the expertise, a share portfolio. So he might decide to set up a fund, and that fund might be a FTSE 100 fund, and it will just buy stocks and shares in the top 100 companies on the FTSE. The reason you might be interested in that sort of fund is that it would probably produce a pretty good income, because what tends to happen is larger companies make consistent profits and are able to pay those out as dividends, whereas smaller companies are probably in their growth phase. You're looking to get capital growth out of those companies, but they would tend to reinvest their profits in building their business further. So you tend to buy big cap companies for income and small cap companies for growth. And indeed, some funds are marketed as growth funds, some funds are marketed as income funds, and you generally find that the big companies are in the growth and the smaller companies are in the the big companies are in the income sector and the smaller companies are in the growth sector. So we spend a fair bit of time on stocks and shares. Well, let's have a quick look at fixed interest. Or what I should say is fixed income. Sorry, not fixed interest, fixed income. Fixed income investments are loan notes issued by governments, sometimes referred to as sovereign debt, and by companies, usually referred to as corporate bonds. Loan notes are generally regarded as pretty secure and pay relatively low rates. Loan rates that are regarded as pretty secure generally pay relatively low rates of interest, while higher risk loan notes, usually issued by smaller companies with a poor trading record and were once referred to as junk bonds, offer high interest, but there is then a real chance of default, which means you could lose your money. Some may recall the Eurozone debt crisis, where countries such as Greece and Spain had to pay relatively high rates of interest to secure funding of their sovereign debt. The market puts a premium on fiscal stability and sound government spending plans and applies similar reasoning to the corporate world. Well-established, well-run businesses pay lower rates of interest than companies new to the market or those in troubles. The interesting thing is that these fixed income notes pay fixed or variable rates of interest and behave differently to stocks and shares in different market conditions. And this is why we want diversification, why you'd want to hold some stocks and shares and some fixed income investments. Money market investments are effectively a similar type of vehicle. But the fundamental difference is money market tends to be short term, while fixed income tends to be longer term. The money market consists of financial institutions and dealers in money or credit who wish to either borrow or lend, and participants borrow and lend for short periods of time, typically up to 13 months. Money markets trade in short-term financial instruments, commonly called paper. This contrasts with the capital market for longer-term funding, which is supplied by bonds and equity. The core of the money market consists of interbank lending, banks borrowing and lending to each other using commercial paper or repurchase agreements and similar instruments. These instruments are often benchmarked to LIBOR, the London Interbank Offer Rate, for the appropriate term and currency. Finance companies typically fund themselves by issuing large amounts of asset-backed commercial paper, which is secured by the pledge of eligible assets. Examples of eligible assets include loans on cars, credit card receivables, residential and commercial mortgage loans, and other such things. In the United States, federal, state, and local governments all issue paper to meet funding needs. They do it in the UK too. States and local governments issue municipal paper, while the US Treasury issues Treasury bills to fund the US public debt. And it's generally regarded that US Treasury bills are some of the most secure paper, or is some of the most secure paper currently circulating. But the US owes an awful lot of money. The money market functions to provide financing for trade, financing for industry. It's a profitable investment for those who get it right. It helps fund the self-sufficiency of commercial banks, and it helps fund central banks, indirectly, governments in the same way. So that's given you a little bit of a taste of the various asset classes there are out there. How have these various asset classes performed? Well, I have in front of me, and I wish you could see it, a chart. And it marks the growth of £100 deposited in 1950 to the end of 2013. If you'd put your £100 into gilts, and gilts are the government loan notes, government bonds, then your £100 worth of bonds would now be worth £73. Not such a great investment. But if you'd reinvested the interest that you had received from those gilts, you'd actually have £7,200, which is a blooming sight better. If you'd have put your money in a building society, you would have had £5,526. Just to keep pace with inflation, you would have needed £2,974. So let me just go those numbers again, because it takes a bit of getting your head round. £100 invested between 1950 and the end of 2013 would have needed to grow to just under £3,000, 30 times its value, to keep pace with inflation. UK Building Society deposit would have been worth £5,526, but of course, if you'd have been paying tax on your income, and most people would have been paying tax on their income, the truth is that money would have been worth less than you needed to keep pace with inflation. Gilts would have done rather better, £7,200. If you'd have bought shares, the capital value of your shares would have grown from £100 to £10,000. But there's a sting in the tail, and this one you probably won't believe, but I promise you is true and is delivered by the most worthy organisation I can think of. If you'd have reinvested your 3% dividend yield every year between 1950 and the end of 2013, you would have had £153,000 worth of shares. So £3,000 to keep pace with inflation, £5,500 on deposit in a building society, just over £7,000 on gilts with income reinvested, but £153,000 if you'd have bought stocks and shares all that time ago. Now, the problem with stocks and shares on their own as an asset class is that they can fluctuate wildly in the very short term based on concerns over maybe the oil price, or there might be a war in a particular region, or general sentiment, or an economic slowdown. Any of those events can have a profound impact on the value of stocks and shares at a particular moment in time. So for that reason, it's never a good idea to put all your money into that single one asset class, and it should be avoided at all costs effectively. But the truth is, over the longer term, stocks and shares have done quite well. So you just need to balance the risk that you're going to get a sudden downturn with the reward that they have historically performed better than any other asset class. Of course, the regulator risk warning that we all now know, and can, I think just about everybody listening can repeat this in their sleep: investments go down as well as up, and past performance is no guarantee of future returns. But let's just, I want to give you an example of real market volatility. In the early 1970s, the stock market in the UK was going like Topsy. It was really, really motoring very hard indeed. And in point of fact, lots of people were piling into the market at that point, and it was just almost a guaranteed way of making money. Right up until the OPEC oil producing countries in decided that they were going to double the price of oil overnight. And the chart here that I'm looking at shows UK share prices almost falling off a cliff, and prices just plummeted, absolutely plummeted. And if you'd have been cashed your investments a year after their peak there, you would have lost nearly all your money. But here's the thing. 1972 to 1973, massive falls. By 1975-6, values had returned in full. So even if you'd bought at the absolute peak of the market before that 1972-3 crash, bought out by the OPEC price rise, 4 years later, you would have had your money back in full. So this is the difference between volatility and loss. If you had panicked, sold your investments, you would have crystallized a loss, you would have lost a lot of money, and that would have been tragic. If, on the other hand, you had held your nerve, didn't need to take your money out, you would have seen reasonable returns. And in point of fact, for the next 20 years, pretty much, 30 years even, from 1974 on, the market just continued to grow and grow and grow, and we didn't have a blip until on this chart, 1998. So I suppose that's 20 years. So there was just, it was really interesting to see the difference between fluctuation, which is just the market having a hiccup, and loss, which is you selling the assets for less than you paid for them. So we've talked about relative performance of asset classes, but there is another another set of numbers I just want to put in front of you just briefly. And interestingly, my graph that I brought with me has printed out without its key. So I've got a whole pile of colour blocks standing on each other, and I can't remember what they mean. But in 1989, I happen to know for a fact that the top performing asset class was emerging markets. And that asset class in the calendar year 1989 returned 40.53%. And in today's terms, that sounds fantastic, spectacular, mind-blowing and wonderful. And we're all saying, well, we're going to put all our money in emerging markets. It's brilliant. And in fact, it did pretty well the next year. It did 22.96% in the next year in that same asset class. The third year, 1991, emerging markets went down in value by 13.51%, and they were the worst performing asset class. The year after that, 92, they did 0.42%, and they were four up, five up from the bottom. You get the idea. Asset class performance is variable, and it goes down and up and down and up and down and up, both in terms of absolute performance, how the asset class performs itself, and in terms of a relative performance, how the asset class performs relative to other asset classes. And in point of fact, if you could see this chart, which tracks something like 15 different asset classes, all of them change their relative position year on year. Now, you'd make your money if you had a crystal ball and you could decide which asset class was going to be the top performer next year. But the truth is, unless you are incredibly lucky, and I think luck plays a huge amount in some of these forecasts, it's almost impossible to predict. The one thing that's very interesting in this chart is that somewhere in the middle of these columns of 15 different asset classes, the one that's consistently in the middle, no peaks, no troughs, but just consistently in the middle, is a little black box. And that showed 22% in 89, 8.6 in 90, 2% in 91, it showed 14% in 1996, 19% in 99, 15.91 in 2000. It showed a couple of minuses, but it's all the way through, it's done somewhere around the middle. And actually, that is not a single asset class. That is the performance of an investment in all the asset classes equally, just balancing between each other. And for that reason, we recommend to all our clients, diversify, diversify, diversify. Do not put all your eggs in one basket. Spread your money between the different asset classes so that when market conditions change, some asset classes will do well, some asset classes will not do so well. But effectively what you've done is you've insulated yourself from the worst, biggest swings that could really hurt you. So how do you access collective investments? We've talked about what they are, we've talked about where they invest, but how do you actually get hold of them? Well, you can buy collective investments off the page in a newspaper, you can buy them in the ISA season, you always buy them, well, I say always, nearly always buy them when you buy a pension plan, and you often buy them when you buy an investment bond from an insurance company. But those are just different types of tax wrapper. Effectively, collective investments are usually distributed as open-ended investment company shares these days, or OICs, as they're sometimes referred to. There's still quite a fair few structured as unit trust. The differences between the two are pretty much technical, but effectively, the investment company buys some more assets, issues some more units, and then when you want to in cash, they just sell your units. And that means that you've got a free market in those investments, and it's a pretty liquid investment, and it's very good for you. Another way of doing it is to buy through investment trusts. Now, investment trusts issue a fixed number of shares in a vehicle that itself holds the investments. So you don't hold the investments directly. You hold paper on a company that itself holds the investments. And the reason for that structure is it gives you other investment opportunities, which are you could buy your paper in the investment company at a premium or a discount to the underlying investment value. And again, there's technical reasons why that might be appropriate, why that might happen, and we haven't really got time to go into it today, but it's an extra level of complexity. And then an extra level of risk is the fact that the investment company itself, if the investment trust, has the capacity to borrow money to buy more investments if the directors of the investment company think there's money to be made in a certain asset class. So you can get geared returns, which can be very attractive. You see that with buy-to-let property. But you can also get geared losses, which are not so attractive. So it's a bit of a trade-off to decide how you want to play. Facts and figures, we tend to favour open-ended investment companies because there's dead straightforward correlation. The value of the assets tracks directly to the value of the unit price, so you know exactly what you're dealing with. Now, you can put these units into a number of different tax wrappers. So you could put it, we said, into a pension plan, and that's dead straightforward. Very attractive thing to do because, of course, you get tax relief on your contributions to pension, something we've banged on about, and growth in pensions is largely tax-free. You might put your money into an ISA, or NISA as it's now referred to, the new ISA. And the new ISA limit for the current tax year is £15,000. So if you are a couple, you can have £15,000 each. And for most people, 30 grand would be quite a lot of investment in 1 year. You can buy them direct. You can buy collectives direct, either from a fund management company or on something called a wrap platform. And you could also buy them through an insurance company investment bond where they hold units. Now, there are different consequences of each of these wrappers. We've said pensions and ISAs roll up pretty much tax-free. OEICs and unit trusts and indeed investment trusts produce capital gains when you buy or sell them, or capital losses, and you would pay capital gains tax on those, on any gains that you made, subject to your personal allowance of £11,000 a hit. And you pay income tax on the income arising during a tax year. If you were in an investment bond, the investment bond provides for capital gains tax and income tax internally. And effectively, there's an internal tax clock ticking at about 19%. The structure of it has to do with corporation tax, but effectively, you as an investor, if the investments did 10%, you'd effectively see 8. Whereas if you did 10% in a collective, you'd see the 10%. You might have some personal tax liability on that money. But of course, if you're a non-taxpayer or you can manage your capital gains tax, then you would not have that tax to pay. But investment bonds have a particular use. They're deemed by the revenue to be a non-income producing asset, a marvellous term because they do pay income, but that's deemed to be a return of capital. And effectively, that means that that has tax advantages in trusts and for higher rate taxpayers if you play the cards right. So it's worth being aware of. The rules, however, are very simple. Blend your holdings. Have some money to deal with emergencies. Pay off your debt. Diversify. Keep your individual investments under review. Manage your capital gains tax. Keep your plans and strategy under review. And make sure that as your life circumstances change and your capacity for loss and attitude to risk changes over time, you blend with it. Unless you're an investment expert, I strongly recommend you take independent financial advice. And as I'm doing this show and you're listening to me, why don't you give us a call at Facts and Figures? You can reach us on 01233 722922, or you can tweet the show at moneytalk_guru, or you could look at the Facts and Figures website, which is www.fffp.co.uk. My name is Simon Webster. This has been Money Talk. It's been great to have